I'm Greg Johnson. Ask me anything. I enjoy doing these AMAs. People often give me really challenging questions, thoughtful questions, questions about things like, how do I want to die? Or have I had a midlife crisis or whatever? And so I just want to dive in. So if you would like to send your questions, comments, suggestions, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. You can also send them to me in the chat over at Odyssey. I very much appreciate that. Or the DLive chat with your diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, etc. I appreciate that. So I have a few questions here already. The first one is from Mary Ann, who's now a regular commentator. She sends $5. I very much appreciate it. She asks, what is your Myers-Briggs personality type? I love questions like this. I actually learned my Myers-Briggs personality type because I think about 8 or 10 years ago on one of these alt-rightish sorts of forums or message boards, somebody asked about that. And so I know I had taken the test years before and I'd forgotten what the result was. So I took an online test and I turned out to be an INTJ, introverted, intuitive thinking, judging type, which is pretty much what I predicted I would come out to be. And it's probably I was predicting it because I remembered getting the same results 20 or 30 years before. I don't know. But anyway, apparently this is a very uncommon personality type in the population as a whole, but there are remarkably many of this type in our particular movement, in our particular sphere. So I thought that was really an interesting thing. And there's a lot of predictive power to the Myers-Briggs personality types. You can read about it. You can dismiss it like it's astrology if you want, but heck, there's a lot of predictive power in astrology too, for whatever reason. And I do find these personality types extremely useful. So if you wonder why you have certain strengths and weaknesses and certain kinds of conflicts or harmonies with other people around you, a lot of it has to do with character types. And there are many different ways of articulating what those character types are and understanding their dynamics, their interactions. And Myers-Briggs is one of the best. So anyway, I encourage you to look into that. It's an interesting tool for self-understanding and also understanding how you relate to others. I have another question here from Sutton. Sutton, of course, has been with Countercurrents, I think, since 2010, 2011. We could go back and search for his comments. And he just asks the following question. Fill in the blank. Welcome to heaven. Here's your harp. Welcome to hell. Here's your blank. Okay. This is, I guess I must have mentioned a particular Far Side cartoon that I absolutely loved from way back when. Gary Larson, the Far Side, he had a cartoon where it goes, welcome to heaven, here's your harp. Welcome to hell, here's your accordion. And I always bristled against that. It's hilarious. It's really funny, but I always bristled against that because I like accordion music. What can I say? So anyway, I must have mentioned that sometime, which is why Sutton is bringing it up. So Sutton wonders what I think the musical soundtrack of hell would be like. If they're listening to harps in heaven, what are they listening to in hell? Well, they're listening to hip hop in hell. Sorry, guys. I know there are guys in our sphere, especially America First guys and Zoomers who like hip hop, but I honestly think it's the soundtrack of hell as I conceive of it. Sorry about that. I would rather listen to Muzak, elevator Muzak, because actually some of it has nice melodies rather than hip hop. That just completely drives me mad. Anyway, I know Nick Gilvey's written nice things about hip hop too. Anyway, I appreciate the question. And Sutton also sent in $5. Another longtime questioner, commentator, listener, Lovecraft's Cat has written in. And his question is really pretty thoughtful. He says, how do you know you're having an effect as a white advocate? Well, there are a number of answers to this. How do I know that I'm having an effect as a white advocate? Well, first of all, there's web traffic. I created Countercurrents along with Michael Polignano back in 2010. And our web traffic started increasing pretty much regularly, month after month, year after year, year after year. We've had our ups and downs. We've suffered all kinds of search engine Googling. Google should be a dirty word, right? They have Googled our search engine results so that people can't find us as easily as they otherwise should if they just had objective algorithms. So yeah, we've definitely been Googled over and over again. And there would be times when we were having steady growth and then suddenly things would plateau. And I would look and I would find that certain articles that were staples that were constantly being visited hundreds or thousands of times every month no longer were showing up in people's searches, and therefore people weren't coming to these things. We were just being Googled out of traffic, basically. But despite that, we keep growing. I think our traffic now is about twice what it was at the beginning of 2019. That's pretty good. And it will continue to grow. It generally goes through patterns of plateauing for a while and then shooting up and then plateauing for a while. Why does that happen? I don't know. It goes up because something happens in the world. Trayvon Martin was very, very good for Countercurrents and our movement in general. The migrant crisis in Europe was very good for Countercurrents and our movement in general. So the Trump presidency sent our traffic through the roof. So there are a lot of things that cause greater interest. Black Lives Matter. Folks, leftists out there, you don't understand that we feed off of you. We feed off of your outrages. We feed off of your quote-unquote successes, right? And we're profiting from your decline. So yeah, you do stupid things. You send people our way. The primary force that drives people towards white identity politics is the establishment itself, multiculturalism, globalization, and all the disastrous consequences they lead to, and all the outrageous lies and cover-ups that the establishment engages in. That's the primary driving force of white identity politics. So that's one way we know, through web traffic, and it's a pretty objective measure. Then there are testimonials. I meet people, right, who say, you influenced me in this way or that way. Or people will write to me and say, you influenced me in this way or that way. I know people who are white advocates now who never heard of white advocacy, white nationalism, or anything until they stumbled across a movie review that I wrote as Trevor Lynch. I've had more than a few people say that it was my reviews of Christopher Nolan's Batman movies that got them in the rabbit hole and basically into our world eventually. More than a few people have said that. I think that's kind of fascinating. So there are testimonials, but those are few and far between. A lot of people, they'll listen to your words, they'll read your work, but they won't admit to it. I think it's very interesting that Ethan Ralph read that comment that Jim Goad made about optics, right? The truth is that everybody reads Countercurrents, not literally everybody, but everybody who's heard of Countercurrents, everybody in our sphere reads Countercurrents. I wouldn't be surprised if major political figures peek at Countercurrents from time to time. A lot of people read Countercurrents. Everybody in our movement reads Countercurrents. Everybody who's anybody reads Countercurrents. But I don't hear objective evidence of that from a lot of these people. I know there are lots of people, but I hear from very few. I can put very few names to those stats, right? So there are a lot of people who read this, a lot of people who listen to this, who won't admit to it and won't give you any feedback, right? For whatever reason, you just have to accept that. So it's not actually a really good measure of your impact to hear from people. Okay. For every person who says, I really like what you're doing, there are thousands and thousands who probably feel that way, who never say anything. Another measure of impact, I guess, would be book sales, although our books have been suppressed from the largest book-selling platforms on the planet, namely Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. But we've had some respectable sales. especially the White Nationalist Manifesto. And of course, these all the ideas in the manifesto are available for free on the website. So it goes back to the web traffic. But book sales is one thing. We've sold books, and books get passed around, ideas get passed around. Even in our post-literate culture, our stuff is gaining some circulation, definitely. And books are not the primary way that people consume quote-unquote ideas, content anymore, right? But it's the primary way that reflective people with basically attention spans, intelligent people with long attention spans still read books. And I'd like to think that those people matter more than people who just look at memes and read tweets and so forth. Another factor is recognition from colleagues. There are more people in the cause who are known people who regard me as a colleague and treat me in a collegial way. And I find that to be encouraging. There are people who publicly don't like me in the movement, right? But there are people who publicly are my friend. And there are other people who are not so public about it, but they're still colleagues and they give me feedback, and there's a sort of collegiality. So that's another way that you know you're making an impact. You hear from thoughtful people that, yeah, you've had an impact on their thinking. They recommend you. They review your books on their platforms, things like that. That's a way. And finally, I think actually one of the most telling and useful ways of knowing you're making an impact is the haters. Because there seems to be a tendency for the people who like you to be somewhat reticent about that. But the haters aren't reticent, right? If you have a flock of haters, a sort of cackling madmen who seem to hang on your every word and write blog posts and tweets and gabs about practically everything that you say or everything that appears on Countercurrents, that's a sign that you're having an impact. You're driving some people literally mad, or you're sort of confirming them in their madness. But the point is that you're having an impact for good or ill, right? People are agreeing with you or disagreeing with you. And since the haters are more likely to be vocal than the people who like you, if you have a certain group of haters and detractors, that's a sign that you're having an impact, and not just a negative impact, a positive one as well. So this is why you should never get down because of haters. I mean, haters will say all kinds of outrageous things. They'll be unfair to you, etc. And you can feel bad about that. They want you to feel bad. That's why they say these things. They imagine that you're reading their every word, when in fact, a lot of this stuff is just, they're just sort of spewing bile into the internet void in websites that have almost no traffic. The truth is that everybody who's famous, even in a tiny little subculture, a tiny little field, has haters and stalkers. And if you're getting bent out of shape because there are one or two guys who hate you on Twitter or in various comment threads, you're made out of really weak stuff. Just imagine what happens if you're a really famous person. There are crazed stalkers and haters of every celebrity out there. And these people generally don't even know about it. They don't care about it. They can't be bothered with it. Do you think Brad Pitt bothers with the crazed haters and stalkers? I'm sure there are people out there who make mean memes about Brad Pitt and collect all the negative stories about him and share them and things like that. I don't think he knows or cares about it in the least. And honestly, if you're smart about it, I think you can treat it as an indication that you matter in some way, and that your impact is going to always entail that there's going to be a sort of fringe of haters and stalkers and weirdos and obsessive types, and that you can't have any kind of positive success without these people. And again, since your positive success is often with reticent people, a better measure of your impact might be from the level of intense, crazy stalkers and haters that you have. There's one person who literally posts hundreds of comments a day at Countercurrents that all just go into spam. He's this crazy guy in Germany. I just sort of picture him as a cackling madman. I see his stuff because he will come back with a new email and a new IP address, a new name. And so it'll show up a little bit, and then I'll treat it as spam. And then it'll go into the spam, and then I'll check the spam folder, and there'll be 100 raving comments by this lunatic. And you just sort of are appalled at the emptiness of a life that's devoted to hating on you. But it is a sign that I'm making an impact, and that for every crazed lunatic, every cackling lunatic stalker, there are hundreds of people who are taking a positive message. So I find it rather encouraging. Okay, I am just going to check here and see if we've got some more questions and comments. Yeah, I would not be at all surprised if Elon Musk read Countercurrents. Yeah, why not? Well, why not just say it? Say it. I think everybody who's really smart, he's a rocket scientist. Okay, everybody who's really smart and is politically incorrect and likes to grapple with edgy, thorny, meaty, interesting ideas and read Jim Goad for that matter. Everybody who likes that kind of stuff comes to Countercurrents. So yeah, why not Elon Musk? Sure. Good suggestion. Welcome, Elon. I hope you're listening to this. I think you're doing great work. Hey, can you plug Bitcoin again? I'd really like to see the value go back up. Now, just imagine if Elon Musk plugs Bitcoin in the coming week, then crazed people on Twitter will start saying things like, Greg Johnson influenced Elon Musk, right? There was a time on Twitter when some wignat retard was saying that Peter Thiel gave me $18,000 in Bitcoin to defend Harvey Weinstein. This, you just can't make this kind of stuff up. So anyway, why not? These people will be saying that about Countercurrents and Elon Musk. But here's another thing. There's so much of this craziness that it just sort of fades into the background, and it just becomes like the white noise of your life. Okay, so back to entropy. So ABC writes in with $5. Thank you very much. Pope Francis declared that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was caused by NATO barking at Russia's door. Any European born knows the feeling of living under the threat of 6,000 plus hostile Russian nuclear warheads nearby for 70 plus years. Thoughts? Pope Francis must read the UNS review. There's something that the retards on Twitter are going to have fun with too. Pope Francis must read the UNS review because he's repeating these Russian talking points. I don't think the invasion of Ukraine was forced upon Russia by NATO. The Russians have this narrative, this historical narrative. It's a combination of extreme self-pity and extreme entitlement. And they basically explain how they created the world's largest land empire by being simply forced to, by all their mean neighbors. They had to do this for their own self-protection. And it's laughable. Nobody builds the largest land empire on the planet purely in self-defense. So there's a level of dishonesty. And this is very much part of their historical narrative. It's this dishonesty about their own empire, building. Russians cry out in pain as they invade your country. They claim that they're just defending themselves as they invade your country. Russia's been invaded a couple of times from Europe. Of course, Napoleon did it, right? In World War I and World War II, yeah, they were attacked, but they were sort of a part of the aggressors, right? They weren't just attacked out of the blue in those wars. For the most part, Russia has been an aggressor, especially in Eastern Europe. And all of these countries remember this, whereas people in the West, they don't remember their own history, much less Eastern European history. But countries in Eastern Europe know what Russian imperialism is like. The Ukrainians certainly know it from bitter experience. And that's why they want allies against Russia. In the past, Ukrainians looked to the Swedes. They looked to the Turks and later times, Nazi Germany against Russia, for allies against Russia. Today, they look to Europe. They look to the EU and they look to NATO. And the reason why they're looking for allies is because they have lived under constant threat from Russia. And the idea that Russia only did this invasion because the Ukrainians were looking for NATO membership, it's almost as dumb as saying that policing black neighborhoods causes those people to commit crimes. Those black criminals wouldn't be committing those crimes if the police didn't cruise around their neighborhood and radiate out stereotype threats against them. It's that level of stupidity, and it doesn't surprise me that the Pope would say something that stupid, because he's an extremely dumb guy on practically every issue. So thank you, ABC. That's a good question. Friedrich writes in with $15. That's very good. Thank you very much. Very generous. Hello, Greg. I just read your article on Ben Novak's book about abductive logic. Would you please tell us how the work of C.S. Peirce would be useful for us to and recommend some reading? Thank you. Well, Friedrich, that's a huge question. I'm the guy who talks about Heidegger and nationalism. C.S. Peirce is like another whole continent of scholarship. I've read Peirce's main essays. I haven't read the vast amount of his writings, though. I'm a fan. I think he was a genius. I think he was one of America's great thinkers. I'm more of a William James guy myself in terms of American pragmatism. But Peirce was a great thinker about scientific method. And basically what I'll just say is this. Ben Novak wrote a book called Hitler and Abductive Logic. And abductive logic is a term that C.S. Peirce invented. And basically it's his term for the logic of scientific discovery. And it's not necessarily logic in the sense of like arguments, because what abduction does is it involves, and it sounds like kidnapping, right? Unfortunate term. But, you know, there's deduction, induction, and abduction. And abductive logic basically is this. Abductive reasoning involves a kind of intuition whereby you come up with an explanation that ties together a number of puzzling phenomena. The explanation has to actually tie together these phenomena, and you should be able to come up with some kind of predictable consequences that would help you test it, right? It's basically just the ability to create scientific hypotheses that explain things that otherwise are mysterious. And abduction is extremely useful in science, but also in all areas of life. And what Novak does in this book is he shows how abduction is, for instance, the logic of the detective or the tracker. And he talks about two literary sources. One is Sherlock Holmes, which is one of my favorite literary characters, and I love the Conan Doyle stories. I find them fascinating. I've read all of the Sherlock Holmes writings by Arthur Conan Doyle. What does Sherlock Holmes do? He finds things that are mysterious, and then he comes up with a hypothesis that explains it, a guess that explains it, that ties these things together and helps solve the murder. That's what he's doing. Another character that he talks about is Carl Mize, a tracker, Winnetou, a guy who tracks animals. He will look for traces. He will look for footprints or crushed leaves, things like that, and is able to infer the kind of animal that passed. And there's a certain amount of abductive guesswork that goes on there. So how does this have anything to do with Hitler? Well, Hitler and Abductive Logic is the title of his book. And what he tries to do, and I think very successfully does, is show that Hitler's power as an orator and as a writer and as a political leader had a lot to do with his ability to explain things. It wasn't just his ability to, as a lot of people say, appeal to emotions right? It wasn't just the irrational stuff. And you get the little clips of Hitler where he's really excited. And you just see these little clips over and over again. And you think he was some raving madman. You don't realize that these were often taken from the context of larger speeches. They might be like the conclusions, rhetorical conclusions of long arguments, right? Where he gets really passionate to drive the points home. But he actually laid out arguments. And his arguments were abductive. Basically, what he did, and the most powerful thing that he did, is he did things like tie together the strange harmony between capitalists and Bolsheviks. What in the world could possibly unite the Bolsheviks and bankers together? And then he would propose his hypothesis, the racial ethnic element, the Jewish element. And that would fit things together that otherwise didn't fit, and it would create a sense of illumination. People would feel, aha, I understand. Coming up with quote-unquote conspiracy theories is a form of abductive reasoning. You look at various behaviors, you find them difficult to explain, and therefore you posit that there are some unseen forces here that are connecting these otherwise, strangely connected dots, right? You see these patterns, but you don't know what connects them, what causes this. And so that's basically what he said. And I think that abductive reasoning is very, very powerful. And rhetorically, it can be very, very powerful. If you are laying out problems in an article or a speech, it's very, very good to get people wondering, why is this like this? Isn't it strange that left and right are united together on so many interesting questions, right? One of the best examples of this is sort of the populist abduction. People who take party politics at face value are often puzzled. How is it that our guys who are constantly going at it against their guys in these partisan slugfests suddenly all come together very amicably to sign off on certain policies that none of us like? How is it that we vote and vote and we put our guys in power at least half of the time, and they put their guys in power at least half of the time, and yet none of us get what we want? None of us meaning the public. Those kinds of questions can be explained, for instance, if you posit that there's only one party. It's the establishment party. It has different wings. A lot of what they do is scripted and unserious, and that on all serious matters, they're on the same page and they're all really friends and they're all united against us. That explanation is very powerful. If you can lay out the seeming contradictions and puzzling behaviors of party politicians, and then lay out the populist assumption, the populist explanation, that really it's not Democrats versus Republicans, it's the establishment versus the people, and get people looking at it in terms of that paradigm, it's enormously clarifying. So that's an example of how abductive reasoning is extremely useful for us, and how it's rhetorically powerful. First, if you can get people feeling the full confusion of accepting party politics at face value, show them that if they accept party politics at face value, it generates all kinds of puzzles and contradictions, and get them to feel the full level of bewilderment, and then provide them with the clarifying alternative way of looking at things. It's very powerful. It's almost like a mystical breakthrough. It's like an initiation into a new way of seeing things. And once you start seeing things in this new way, it's hard to go back. And so it's a rhetorical technique, but underlying it is an actual technique of reasoning. And I think it's very powerful. So there's a piece that I wrote on Novak's book, Hitler and Abductive Logic, that I think is really important. Also, there's something I wrote on Frank Herbert. It's called The Golden Path, where I talk about how Herbert uses abductive logic or abductive reasoning in the Dune books. But this is one of the things that the elites of the Imperium are taught, especially the Bene Gesserit. I think it's really kind of an interesting slant on what Herbert is doing. Okay, so that's a long answer to a short question, but I very much appreciate it. Let's check and see if there are any more questions here. Jasper wrote in, what everyone thinks of the Third Reich, they had a keen sense for aesthetics. The Norse runes and symbols they used are visually appealing and tapped into ancient traditions. I'm curious about the origin and purpose of these symbols. It's difficult to find resources that don't dismiss it as bizarre Satanism. Do you have any familiarity with the subject? Well, the rune stuff. I'm not really deeply into runes, but we have a guy at Countercurrents, Colin Cleary, who's written a book called What is a Rune? And he's written a number of essays that appear on Countercurrents that went into that book and also into his earlier book, Summoning the Gods. I highly recommend Colin Cleary's work on the runes. So Jasper sent $50 with that. So thank you very much. I highly recommend Cleary. He's the guy who can give you the answers. So I appreciate your support. Horatius14 writes in with $5. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on No White Guilt, Jason Coney, and his dialectics and promotion of white well-being. Do you believe it's as effective against our enemies? Do you see weaknesses in those tactics or beliefs? Well, he's a friend. He's a guy that I've on my side, broadly speaking. I don't know all the ins and outs of his particular approach, though. I know he's the guy who says, look, if somebody accuses you of being a racist, you just accuse them of being anti-white. I think that's appropriate. I think that's appropriate sometimes. I think there are other ways of parrying that charge. You might just say, yeah, but I'm the good kind of racist. There are bad kinds of racists, the evil, cackling, mean people you see on TV and the movies. And then there's the good kind of racism, the good kind of racism that bases itself on experience and protects you by basically coming up with helpful prejudices that allow you to live your life in a dangerous world. There are different ways of doing this. I think he's doing something that's valuable, and I appreciate what he's doing. And I think that if we have any differences, there are differences of emphasis. I think that we have to have a big toolkit, and that he's providing one set of useful rhetorical tools. Thank you for that. That's a good question. And I appreciate the donation of $5. So Gadius wrote in with $10. Again, you're very generous. Thank you very much. You must live in one of two cities for the rest of your life. One is all white, but they're all Antifa. The other is multiracial, and you're the only white, but they're all based. Which one do you pick? This is actually sort of similar to a question that Buttercup Dew phrased on Gab and got a bunch of anger. That's a hard one, because if they're all Antifa, they're all crazy people who would literally murder me, in which case I probably would want to leave. Even if they're all white, if they're all out for my blood, I can't be around them. And what I would do is I'd go to a multiracial place where I had the freedom to be myself and to advocate for these crazed lunatics and try and debug them. But as Sir Oswald Mosley said when he moved to France, you can't clear up a dung heap from underneath it. Meaning he wanted to clear up the dung heap of British politics, but he couldn't do that under the dung heap of British politics. So he had to get out. Maybe it was a cop-out. I don't know. There's a long history of revolutionaries who become expatriates. Ho Chi Minh, I think, was a chef or something in Europe, right? The makers of the Bolshevik Revolution, they were various expats in cities in Europe. So it's not an unknown thing to get out from under the dung heap to clear it up. And especially if the people in the dung heap are trying to kill you, it's perfectly permissible to do that. So yeah, I can sympathize with that. I would rather live in a majority non-white city where people are not trying to kill me than 100% Bolshevik white city where they are trying to kill me. Neither one is a good option, though. And honestly, if it were a choice of living in a white society with a few crazies and a non-white society with no crazies, I'd choose the white society with a few crazies any day. But this is a very, very specific thought experiment. And yeah, if they were all up for my blood, I'd have to leave. Even to save them, I'd have to leave in order to save my life so I can save these people from themselves. That's how I would look at it. So Bartomu wrote in with $5, and I apologize. I somehow overlooked this. It's a question for Jim Goad. What are Jim's thoughts on internet anonymity? I personally think it should be abolished. It makes people act like passive aggressive women, particularly single men in their 30s, I've noticed, or their 20s for that matter, or their teens. And then he has hashtag bring back honor culture. I'm not exactly sure what he would say about this. I'm pretty sure that he looks down upon internet anonymity because he's constantly bouncing people who attack him from behind pseudonyms. I think internet anonymity is a good thing because it allows people to say things that bring harm upon themselves and their families, but happen to be true. And I think that that advances things a bit, but it also enables unserious people to be absolute jerks. All told, I would rather have internet anonymity and Matt Forney's than no internet anonymity and basically be like one of a dozen people saying this stuff because I'm doxxed and it doesn't matter, right? I've self-doxxed. I would rather there be more anonymity and more voices speaking the truth about important matters and have to put up with the jerks. So Friedrich also writes in with $15 and says, cheers. So thank you very much, Friedrich. I appreciate that. Okay. Norse Nature has donated 3 ice creams, Bartleby 1 ice cream, Horatius 1 ice cream, and Norse Nature 2 ice creams. Thank you very much. I'm just going to comment a bit on some of the chat here at Entropy, and then I'm going to take a peek over at Odyssey. Yeah, Ho Chi Minh received his political education in France. I think he also worked as a waiter or a cook in France. So did Ayatollah Khomeini. Yes, exactly. And that's good because I don't want to just be following in the footsteps of Bolsheviks, right? So yeah. Yeah, Reed Johnson likes my quote, liberal democracy is the fine art of not giving the people what they want. Yeah, and once you see through that, you need an explanation of what's really going on. And that has to do with the uniparty and the establishment versus the people. Dr. Jackson Crawford on YouTube covers a lot about runes and Old Norse language. I enjoy his videos. I can second that. I've seen a couple of his videos. I think he's actually a really interesting guy. Yeah, he's a really solid scholar of the Norse. So yeah, that's definitely a good recommendation. Trotsky was from New York, if I'm not mistaken. Well, no, he was from Odessa, I believe, but he spent some time in New York. And, again, he was a revolutionary exile. Board Troll writes in, Antifa is used as a destructive force and compelled by an ideology promising a better future. Is it possible to give them a constructive goal? Yeah, I think so. It's interesting to wonder what motivates a lot of these people. The whole concept of bio-Leninism comes to mind. A lot of these people seem, well, just look at Andy Ngo's mugshots of these Antifa. A lot of them are drug addicts. A lot of them are transsexuals. A lot of them are profoundly alienated, messed up people. I don't know what can be done with these people, but it would be nice to give them positive things to do. I think the first thing that you have to do with these people is you have to realize that they're miserable because they're free in a lot of cases. A lot of these people are miserable because liberalism has created a world where there's just a void of meaning and they're not happy and they don't know what's wrong and they're mutilating their bodies, they're putting junk in them, they're taking hormones, they're taking other kinds of drugs, and they're unhappy. They have too much freedom. And that's really true of our culture in general. But maybe these are especially hard up cases. Maybe these are especially sensitive cases. And they've basically been thrust into a world where you supposedly choose anything you want, create any identity that you want for yourself, and it doesn't satisfy them. It's a meaningless world. The liberal utopia is a world without meaning. and it doesn't satisfy the human soul, and it creates all kinds of pathological behaviors. They're miserable because they're free. I think the first thing you should do is take away their freedom and then find productive things for them to do with their lives. And I think they probably would be a lot happier. Yeah, use them for national service. Make them clean up graffiti. Hell, they were the ones who put it there in many cases. Put them out there cleaning up graffiti. Put them out there restoring the smashed up cityscapes that they created, the dystopian hellscapes that they created. Put them in orange uniforms. Put them in shackles if need be, and put them out there cleaning up the mess they made. And they'd probably actually be happier. It's sad, but true. A lot of these people are miserable because they are free. Yeah, maybe watch Murdoch Murdoch. I don't know about Murdoch Murdoch. I find it really kind of draggy. I think I watched only one Murdoch Murdoch video all the way through. Sorry about that. Maybe I shouldn't have admitted to that. Okay, I have one last question here, and then I'm going to wrap up, unless you throw a few more questions my way. Eric, who sends in many questions, and some I skip. Eric sent in a question a couple weeks ago, and I thought I would save this. Eric asked me what my favorite dinosaur is. It's like, okay, for what it's worth, you know, I was like a lot of little boys. I liked dinosaur books. My parents gave me lots of dinosaur books. And when I was a kid, my favorite dinosaurs were the pterodactyls. I thought they were just really weird and interesting looking. However, as an adult, I was exposed to the Jurassic Park films. And I have to say, it's going to sound like a cliche, my favorite dinosaur is the Velociraptor. Okay. I'm sure that's practically every kid's favorite dinosaur these days. In my time, I don't even remember them in the dinosaur books that I was reading as a kid. Maybe there were a new discovery or something or whatever, but I think they're incredibly cool. So yeah, they're my favorite dinosaurs. All told though, I'm glad they're extinct. I would not want to share the planet with those creatures. They're just too damn scary, but I like the idea of them. Maybe on an island somewhere, if they could be contained, right? Maybe that's a good idea. Okay, folks. So yeah, dump some lemons my way. I appreciate that. Archie Bunker writes in, AOC is always talking about dignified jobs. Those white libtards will not feel edified shoveling dung. They want to run the world and are not fit for it. Absolutely. I remember when I was an undergraduate, there were these Marxist professors in every department, really. They were Marxists everywhere. And these people were dreaming about running AT&T. They wanted to run all the major corporations. They wanted to run the government. And they couldn't even show up for their own office hours, their own posted office hours, right? Yeah, they're not fit to run their own lives in many cases, much less run a country or run a major corporation. Again, I think a lot of leftists are miserable because they're free. There's a wonderful meme of the Kaiser Wilhelm, looking very Prussian, that says you are miserable because you're free. I've reused it many times. I love that meme. Okay. Archie Bunker says, Velociraptors taste just like chicken. Okay, I think that's very good. And the Chris Pratt raptor trainer character in the later films is very cool. Yeah, I absolutely thought Chris Pratt was amazing in that first of the rebooted series. I really liked him. I thought it was an excellent movie. Anyway, folks, I very much appreciate it. It's been fun. I really enjoy all your questions. And so next week we will do the same thing. I will have a guest in the first hour to be determined. It might be James O'Meara, though. Trying to get James to come on to talk about the father of fake news, and that would be Hunter Thompson. He was an absolutely despicable human being, as it turns out, and James has been writing about him. So James wrote an epic piece on Salvador Dali recently, and now he's working on Hunter S. Thompson. I'm hoping that next week I'll have him on. We had an amazing conversation about Thompson a couple weeks ago, And I was thinking, I wish the whole world could listen in on this because it was extremely funny and it was very entertaining and interesting. So I hope that it'll be James. If not James, it'll be somebody else, also very interesting. And I'm just really looking forward to next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. So thank you for the donors. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you to the moderators. And we will be back.